No. A texter says, Highland Radio apparently chose not to report on the new EU asylum migration deal and the fact that Ireland and Denmark has an opt-out of EU immigration policies under the Lisbon Treaty and the fact that a referendum is required in both countries. The objective seems to be kept from the Donegal public or to keep it in the dark. Well, if anyone wants to come on and talk about that, that's fine. I did reference it and I've talked about it a couple of times because I noted that Leo Varadkar, when he was over in Davos, he said that Ireland is likely to opt out of it effectively so we can pay a financial contribution instead of accepting more migrants, this under the new European Union Pact on Migration. And he said that, and he pointed out, and I'm not here to speak on his behalf, but he's on the record as saying it, so it's important to put it on the record because people think we're not talking about it. He said that Ireland has an option to provide financial resources and as an alternative to accepting more migrants under the pact. Now, maybe you're talking about exiting the pact altogether, but the government is certainly exploring the fact and says it's more likely to actually pay a fine and not accept migrants rather than... Now, maybe you're saying there should be an referendum so that we don't actually pay those fines at all. I don't know. But the pact, some of the key points, it introduces a uniform screening process for the identification of non-EU nationals upon their arrival in a member state, developing a common database to detect unauthorised movements, making asylum return and border procedures more efficient, establishing an asylum migration management regulation that will see some member states have the option to pay a monetary contribution rather than accepting migrants. That's the part of it that we're likely to employ. And to prepare the EU for a situation of migration crisis, including the instrumentalization of migrants, which means to organize. Okay, so that is it. We've talked about it on a number of occasions, maybe not in the detail perhaps that you wanted, but there it is. And the latest stance from government seems to be that they are likely to opt out. We shall see. 086 60 25,000 if you want to talk about that or anything. By the way, nothing is vetoed in that regard, by the way. Right, okay, we got this correspondence from a listener who doesn't want to speak, but we want to offer some advice or help. And I'll read it as it was sent to us. Dear Greg, did anyone have issues with employment and the effort in helping you get employment if you have mental health issues? Because I have terrible issues with my mental health, I feel like no one really cares. I just get thrown out on a scheme, but it's not helpful. I feel like I'm just being pushed from pillar to post for years. Something has to be done. People with mental disabilities have a right to work too. We eat just like everyone else. We've a right to a chance instead of being thrown to all of these services and getting no help. According to all employers, we don't have the experience in their field, but it's not our fault. We are willing to work as hard as anybody else, but employment is not willing to help us. It comes across like I have never worked in my life, but I have had paid work that I had worked in for years. Employers are not willing to give you a chance. We're stuck with doing work experience, hoping or thinking we'll get a job at the end of the month or year, which is not always the case, and that's a year wasted. I don't have anywhere else to turn. Please help me. I'm willing to work the same jobs as anyone else. I think employers should see past the mental illness in an interview and should see she or he can get work done and takes directions and is punctual. Employers should be more willing to take on people like us because we feel like we're not wanted. This needs to change. We have bills to pay too. Professor Brendan Kelly is a professor of psychiatry of Trinity College Dublin, and he joins us on the programme now. Good morning, Professor. Thank you so much for your time.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
I am okay. And I think we accept, don't we, that it can be a struggle for people with mental health issues to gain in employment?
Yes, it can be difficult. And the dilemma that your listener outlines is a common one, as I imagine they might know, having spoken to other people who've met with similar difficulties. We know worldwide this is an issue, and there's a couple of things. I suppose the first and biggest thing is this idea of stigma being wrongly associated with mental health issues, mental illness and treatment. And this is very common among employers. Sometimes this is not conscious on their part. It can be unconscious on their part, but it still has the same effect, which is to lock certain people out of paid employment.
From an employer's perspective, are they saying to themselves, I've got two candidates here, and I've got one with no mental health issues, and I've got one with mental health issues, or poor mental health, or however this person describes as mental health issues themselves, are they always going to go with the person that that doesn't present or admit with mental health issues? And if so, what can we do about that?
So not all employers take that attitude, and some of them are very fair. However, it can be difficult to figure out and very difficult to work out, you know, why certain decisions are being made. You know, there is equality legislation, and once a person is in the workplace, it can be easier to identify discrimination or problems. But when it comes to selecting people for employment, sometimes, you know, the category of general suitability and similar phrases are used. But some employers do take a really positive approach to this, but it sounds like your listener hasn't encountered any of those. There are a couple of things that we can do to help. There is a program called Individual Placement and Support, IPS, Individual Placement and Support. And across many community mental health teams in Ireland, there are specific staff members who are trained to provide guidance and support to people with mental health issues who are applying for employment, and they can carry that into the workplace. So sometimes with the person's agreement, this IPS or individual placement and support officer can help support the person in the workplace and hopefully alleviate some of that concern that certain employers might have regarding employing somebody who has a history of mental health issues. One of the enormous difficulties, though, Greg, is this can force people to, you know, not to confide, or force people, to feel ashamed, or to feel like they shouldn't speak out, and so forth. And that is problematic. But in terms of the mental health services, community mental health teams, most of them now have access to what's called IPS, an IPS worker, and they can be. And if your listener punches individual placement and support Donegal into if they're in Donegal, indeed, into a search engine, they will come up with the relevant resource that will provide some support in the search for employment.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, we're talking about difficulties in the workplace with mental health issues. It's not just that. This is we have talked as well, even just last week, someone with endometriosis, for instance, having to take up too much time work and losing their jobs. Also, in terms of, you know, women going through the menopause, for an example. So it's not exclusive to people with mental health issues. Often employers will seemingly take the path of least resistance on either mental health or physical issues.
Yes, and of course, employers, feel an enormous responsibility for their business, for their other employees, and to do everything to ensure their business functions smoothly and well. However, there is legislation, there is equality legislation, and we know that depression, anxiety and stress come under the definition of disability in that legislation. Now, they might not feel like disability in the way many people understand the term, but legally they are included. And in the event of identifiable discrimination, that is a violation of the equality legislation in the area of employment law. But I guess most people are looking for solutions rather than legal battles. So I think the first thing for your listener, it is helpful and important to be honest about these matters insofar as that is possible and judicious when getting employment. It's not necessarily necessary to tell everybody everything. We do have a right to privacy as well. However, if one does have additional needs, it is helpful to be aware of that. There is this IPS support for people with mental health issues, and that can be helpful. But I do empathize deeply with the notion that they are continually put into training courses, internships and unpaid positions. And that is something we need to look at a little bit more, I think, the extent to which that could be exploitative rather than supportive.
But if I were this individual and I was listening to your very good advice, and it's about what schemes are there, I would go, well, how do I even, like, I want to work in at the till in retail. How do I apply for a job or include IPS in that to get where I need to be, if you know what I mean? So, like, do you have a better understanding of, yep, of how? So do IPS have a number of positions that they've worked with employers and they try and match the candidate with the job? Will they go with me and support me in an interview process or make an advance approach to the business? Do you know what I mean? So whilst there is something of a solution there, I wouldn't know where to start with how to put it into practice.
Well, a couple of things. The IPS workers are accessed via community mental health teams around the country. So to take an example, where I work, our IPS worker works with our team. Anyone who is referred to by a GP, for example, for a mental health issue, they can sit down with the IPS worker, who will talk with them about what they've done, what they want to do, can even go through job advertisements, help make up a CV, if necessary, provide support for the person when they're headed off for an interview. Whether or not they attend an interview depends a great deal on, I suppose, the employer holding the interview and the employee. I haven't heard of one attending often, but I have heard of an IPS worker going on the bus with somebody, you know, and sitting outside and being supportive mm-hmm. in that way. So it depends a little bit on what the person wants or needs. And with the person's permission and the employer's cooperation, a level of support can be carried into the workplace as well. So it varies a lot, but certainly the IPS workers I've seen have been really helpful, really pragmatic, mm-hmm. And very supportive in often it's very simple forms of support that can mean so very much, or they liaise with people's families about supporting them. But the primary access is through a community mental health team, one of the HSE community teams, and usually people are referred by GPs to those services.
Yeah, and I've no doubt the IPS do great work in that regard. Just in terms of, you know, transparency, or however one might call it, I don't know why this individual might feel that they need to. Do you feel like, is it easy to determine when it's appropriate to perhaps tell a prospective employer of your of a mental disability or a mental illness, or when it's private? Either, you know, I mean, there could be an overshare, not in this person's case, but mm-hmm. do you know what I mean? Like, do people struggle? I wonder what should be said, when it should be said.
That's a very interesting question, Greg, and obviously it'll vary from person to person, but the responsibility on the employer is to provide what's called reasonable accommodation, mm-hmm. and this means taking the necessary measures to support someone in the workplace. They can only do that if they know what they're supposed to be doing. And one of the points employers make is, if people don't tell them in some way about what they need, then they can't necessarily provide it.
But you have
it.
To have real faith in the recruitment process to go on that journey with the employer.
You do. Now, some people choose not necessarily to say this at the point of interview or point of recruitment, but maybe say it a little bit later on before taking up position. But other people judge that it is the right thing to do to be, you know, very direct and open about this at the time of interview or time of recruitment. But one way or other, if some kind of what's called reasonable accommodation is needed, the employer does need to know. And my experience of them is often they like to know. And you do need to have faith in the recruitment process that won't impact on that if you confide at that stage.
Yeah, and I think for our listener, if they do engage with the individual placement support in the first instance, I think there's even just working it through, talking it through will be beneficial, because you can relate to the comments that this person has made, and hopefully that can be a pathway for them achieving what they want to achieve. It must be incredibly frustrating to feel like you're being treated different, yet you have all the same wants and needs as everybody else, and you want to be earning and you want to be paying your bills, but you pass from pillar to post, as the listener said. So hopefully IPS might be able to, well, firstly, in the first instance, understand Brendan, but also maybe give some practical advice going forward.
Well, absolutely. They certainly understand and can give the practical advice. And, you know, the frustrating thing is not only having the same wants and needs, but also the same potential to give and to contribute and to participate and to support other people in workplaces as well. So realizing that can be more challenging. And that is so regrettable. That email echoes very strongly with what I see. But hopefully with some support, they can take some steps forward.
Yeah. And finally, I suppose, you know, this maybe is a symptom of wider society, and we say all the right things, don't we? But, you know, do we have sort of this built-in bias, this built-in judgment of people maybe seeing mental health as a weakness or as a flaw that cannot be overcome? I'm not attributing that to anyone, but you just wonder, really, is this symptomatic of really, we talk the talk, but are we walking the walk in terms of, you know, accepting people's mental illnesses the same as we do with physical illness, and we still have a lot of work to do in that area, don't get me wrong, but I don't know, I think this is just maybe the face of what's bubbling underneath sometimes.
Yes, look, it's really good in recent years. We do talk the talk, and that is important that people can talk about these and similar things. But we still have huge blind spots, you know, for people who have mental health problems that cannot be remedied through lifestyle measures and diet and mindfulness and all these good things. You know, we still tend to deny the existence of these continued problems in many people that require ongoing support. So talking the talk is certainly good, but this is indeed symptomatic of something much broader and in a sense much deeper, which is struggling to accept this this difference, yeah, or variability between people. But look, I'm confident progress can be made. We've made some progress so far, although as your email point highlights, more needs to be done.
Yeah, and just very finally, and picked up on something I've mentioned on this program before, when we talk about mental health, it's so often, and the advocates, and listen, fair play to them, I've no issue with them whatsoever, but it's often a story of a beginning, a middle, and an end almost, whereas for the majority, I think, or many people with mental health, it's not the story's not told like that. This person is living with their mental health issues all of the time. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And it's often presented that, you know, and I'm not saying help isn't there, but it's often presented that, as I say, with those that advocate, it's, you know, I was in this position, then I went through this, and now I'm here. But life, unfortunately, is not quite that simple all of the time.
No, and sometimes I feel as a society we're in a state of denial about people who have enduring or continued mental health problems or mental health difficulties, and in, particularly for what it's worth, in denial about how their families manage with this over the years. So many families doing such good work over a long period of time, and their needs are often not met in supporting a family member with enduring mental health difficulties. We can do an awful lot better with support and treatment than we're currently doing. But I am, certainly the past few years, been very encouraged by the support that's starting to build for employment, because, you know, helping people to build and sustain lives in which they are connected, in which they are contributing, and in which they feel that community is really the way forward for people with enduring challenges.
Very good. And on that more positive outlook, we'll leave it there. Professor Brendan Kelly, hopefully we've been able to offer some helpful information to that listener. We really appreciate your time. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
Professor Brendan Kelly, Professor of Psychiatry of Trinity College Dublin. Great to have Brendan Devaney back in studio. Bren, how are you getting on?
Good man, Greg. Good, yeah.
Good stuff. Right, we'll start with the game yesterday. Donegal were good. It was a good game. Was it a good game? Sometimes I think games are good and then others say they're not good. I thought it was a good game of football. What did you think?
Yeah, I suppose, Greg, when you look at it maybe from the week previous with Derry, there was terrible. two real blocks of defence happening, and particularly first half was horribly cagey. Derry actually played not bad in the second half from their perspective. We didn't play at all. So it kind of, there was a wee few question marks, because people were saying the teams we played against in the McKenna Cup maybe weren't going that well and were very trialling players and that. So there was this Cork game, outside the away game against Armagh, this Cork game, many people thought could be a good test for us. But even though we were depleted in pre-game, you know, we lost our main scorer, Oisin Gallen, and Oisin was on commentary with me there, said, you know, where the score's going to come from. So you're looking around, it's, listen,
everywhere.
You know, you had 12 different scores, you know, and I was naming out people. I was kind of like, I may as well name the team.
Yeah.
Because, you know, even Mulready's going to come out and have a go as well, the goalkeeper. And that is what happened. I mean, that's modern football now. So missing, listen, there's about six players kind of injured at the minute and close to coming back in that. So to do Cork the way we did.
What now, impressed you? What if there was one takeaway for the performance, what was it?
Do you know what? There seemed to be a great attitude with the boys. The work rate was unbelievable. I mean, the tackling was superb, tackling in numbers, and then the work rate off the ball. I mean, at times up front there, I was watching Dara Boyle going over and back, and he actually had very little chance of getting to the ball because the man could go back to the keeper or he had options. But he was sprinting.
Taking scores seemed to be really quite effective.
The point taking was unreal. I mean, to hit 120 on a day like that, Greg, because, you know, at halftime, the famous Brian McInniff would always say, you know, we're playing under the breeze. There's like Donegal people to be able to play in the breeze. We're used to it. And we played far better against the breeze than we actually did with it. And, you know, we were reeling off scores. I think at one stage, Towards the end of the first half there, there was 5 or 6 points in a row. Just, you know, when you keep hitting there, Greg, you normally have a ratio of scores to points, but it must have been up in about the 80% there yesterday. So it was brilliant.
It could have been 1-6, this whole fly goalie situation.
Yeah.
I hate it, but I don't. Maybe I don't understand it. But I'll tell you, when you get caught out, and we did it last week, and we were the victims this week, it's horrible to see.
Yeah, and listen, here's what the league's about, like the Moran McKenna Cup. Now, of course, listen, you want to get promoted and that, and I think Donegal will get promoted, but you got to learn things. So there's a time to learn, like, why was Mourinho in the position he's in at that point? To me, if a keeper comes out, and you see it a lot, we're just talking about Derry there with Lynch, he doesn't tend to come out until there's he needs an overload against the blanket defence. I think there's maybe where you want your keeper to maybe join, but in
you
the first...
have players behind you, or yeah. able to sprint
in the first you. Half, there was a ball came across to Mourinho, and he lost possession, and he was up the pitch, and we had 5 or 6 defenders behind him. Mm. And I was thinking to myself, there's probably no need then because the other team's backing off. You have spare men anyway. Mm-hmm. But I guess, listen, first game, I'm easy.
No, it's not on Gavin. It's not, that's not it, but
yeah.
It is a factor of modern football and you have to talk about it, but it's not talked about the individuals as such, because, I mean, we are a local amateur sport, and I get that, right? But it is what people are talking about, or what is a factor. The advantage is, the advantage of it is that it's an extra person, yeah. Right? But the disadvantage is you have to work really hard often for 3 points, and if it goes wrong, and it probably will go wrong once or twice a game, those 3 points, like, if that were... Now, you might not do it late on in a game, or you might be pushing on in a game. If that happens later in the season when it's more important, then everyone's going to be talking
sure,
about it. Do you get
sure,
where I'm coming
sure.
from? So,
and if you look at the start of that second half, we people are saying that 6 points enough in that, because the halves don't work like that. They don't just fit like that. Of course, as I say, we played better under the breeze. But we hit the first 3 points. We go 9 up and you think, right, we're in control here. And then bang, that's all undone by getting caught out. And I suppose with the breeze, that long kick pass, it just carried over McCall's fingertips. It came down to inches, but it does look bad when the ball's put under an empty net. But, Greg, listen, you won a match and you got to take learnings from that. And I suppose that's what Donegal...
Yeah, it could be interesting to see, yeah. Or if managers see that as an acceptable gamble for what they see as the advantage. Because, I mean, Jim McGuinness knows his stuff. And you don't have a goalie going forward like that unless they're saying, right, you've got a bit of freedom to do that, which is fine. And as I say, it's nothing against Gavin. It's just an interesting... it's an interesting element of the modern game.
Definitely.
Not about the individuals.
It's something, I suppose, with Gavin coming in, that was his first league game. You know, he had a great game the last day against Derry as well. So it's important to have them options.
And there was a couple of interventions from him higher up the pitch, actually, which probably saved points if you wanted to really dig deep into it.
His catch early on as well, Greg, when there was a goal on, he took a bit of a hit. So certainly, I mean, Cork, I don't know, they were very poor second half. I don't want to take anything away from our boys, but Cork were very poor. I thought there'd be much more about them. I was chatting to Kevin Walsh after the match, no ex-Galway guys involved there with Cleary and the management. I was kind of thinking, like, what happened? Just, you know, Cork are always known as bad travellers, and maybe the distance affected them a bit, but they really fell out of the game. They were offering something in the first half. Again, I thought they would have came at us a bit in the second half. But listen, not taking anything away from our boys, we played well. You know.
And now another win... particularly given the opposition, leaves Donegal in a really good position, even just after a couple of games. But, and I also read somewhere else someone saying that this Donegal team would give most teams a good run for their money. We don't want to get carried away either, do we?
No, well, listen, Greg, that was one of the tougher games, I think, in the division in many ways. And you look at it with Cavan away now, you know, with Fermanagh at home, Armagh away, Louth at home, Kildare away, and Meath at home. Really, I mean, Armagh only won by a point at the weekend against Louth. You know, there's no reason why Donegal going to every one of those games expecting to win them, and particularly the fact we have 4 home games, I would be very confident now that we should have it done even before we play Meath at home, to go up. So the Ulster teams at the weekend, like, it was a phenomenal.
Everyone won except Fermanagh, didn't they?
And they drew, and even that was a good draw. It was
a
way to Meath.
There was not one.
They're up. Everybody's tapping them to get relegated. Yeah. So that was a great performance by them, and everybody else won. So it just shows you the strength of the Ulster sides, you know.
Right, there'll be obviously plenty of reaction to that on tonight's show. Disappointment for the Donegal ladies, losing at 1-8 to 1-4 to Kildare.
Yeah, Kildare, I suppose, teaming up. They won the intermediate last year, Greg, you know. So listen, John McNulty is unearthing a new team there.
This is a young Donegal side too, isn't it? Yeah, so that has to be factored in. They have to learn on the job, some of them. Yeah. Now, I'm not saying they're not experienced, but there is a bit of a learning at this level on the job for these women.
Exactly. And listen, after you've won a title like that, there's Kildare going to be kind of be a team on an upward curve, you know. So I suppose it's a bit of learning for Donegal. And Maureen O'Donnell was at the game. She's going to give us her take on it. So listen, it was one of those matches, Greg. I think, as you say, you have certain teams that are further down the line than others, and I think that was, again, it's a league game, it's a learning curve, and John's just done there. But listen, he's a top coach, he'll get things right.
He knows the story. A bit of controversy on the show this morning in that, and you know, Little, is it Little or Aldi? I think it's Little, saying, you know, go out, support the girls, you don't want them playing in an empty stadium and all that kind of stuff. But we also have to make decisions as fans, right? And you really have to pick whether to go and watch the Donegal women or to go and watch the Donegal fellas. That's crazy in this day and age, that especially with that campaign that's ongoing, it's almost embarrassing that you see a poor crowd at the Donegal women's game. Not poor, but not the because probably people says, well, I want to go and see Donegal's opener in the league. Either a doubleheader or schedule them differently. You know, it's not putting loads of ads in the telly when you're putting people in a position they have to make a choice.
Yeah, funny. I was down at Pettigo's Dinner Dance on Friday night.
Quiet enough night, are you?
They know how to enjoy themselves. Let me tell you, what a night. The voice was kind of gone. You could still hear him back. I was panicking.
Barry White now. Legendary soul singer.
Oh, God. I would love to blame it on some late night singing, but it was more just shouting and roaring.
Your singing.
What a night's crack. But Mary Colvin was there, of course, our new chairman, and Sean Dunyan's there. Sean's got a few moves, by the way, with a couple of dance-offs there in Terman Hall. What a place that is. I'd never been in this place before. But Micheál Nochtain was there. He's the ladies, obviously president, and doing a great job there. But he just talked about the amalgamation of the two, Greg. Of course, they were separate bodies for a long time. And until they come together properly, that's when you'll kind of iron all these things out. And they are integrating. But at the minute, things like that should never happen. Like, you know, we need to give as much opportunity as we can for everybody.
There's no point sort of blaming people for not supporting the game and then scheduling it where they have to avoid it. You know what I mean? I think people have to be fair.
Yes.
Right, so Ryan Ferry of the Donegal News, Michael Hegarty on all the weekend's footballing action. And a lot to unpack there. We've only scraped the surface there. You mentioned Maureen O'Donnell. It'll be interesting to see her assessment of that team and where it's going. Matter of hurlings to be discussed as well.
Yeah, Mickey McCann's on. The legendary Mickey McCann. What a man in Donegal hurling. He's taking up the job again another season. And Mickey's league campaign and Donegal's league campaign, Division 2B, starts away to Wicklow this weekend. And again, they have five games. Going to be a tough league because they've got three away and two at home, Greg. But Division 2B, very competitive with our neighbours, Derry and Tyrone in there. So some interesting games coming up.
So just back to the Donegal game, because I wasn't able to really focus on it. Toddler pulling up my ears and all that kind of stuff. So Donegal were playing against the wind in the first half?
No, with it.
I was thinking, makes sense, because...
And hey, they had some brilliant scores. I mean, you look at Oran Doherty there, you know, just starting to nail down a place with Donegal. He had three phenomenal points that first half. And outside the boot strikes.
Yeah.
Like when I used to play...
Sometimes when that goes wrong, you go, just kick it with the laces.
But there were so many strikes with the left foot as well in that. And just shows you the skills of the game. And see, because of blanket defence now, you often have to hit the shot on the run. Mm. So the outside the boot is commanded a lot. Now you can get good distance in that. And I interviewed Kieran Thompson after the game because he had a monster kick as well. He does that strike as well.
Did you ever kick across the ball, Brendan?
I did a few times, maybe by accident.
That was for Finn Harps.
I'll tell you, get the champagnes on.
Okay. So if you want any sense out of Brendan, he was in Pettigo, and if you go to Pettigo, it's really Wednesday or Thursday before you start getting a bit of sense.
Jesus, I'll tell you what, fair play. What a great club. Hey, we had a phenomenal night. I'll be keeping an eye out on their evolution, and I say in their...
Fantastic. Well, they booked you as a speaker and they couldn't get better. You're very entertaining in all that regards. Okay, Brendan, listen, thank you very much indeed. Brendan Devenny and the DL Debate return after the 7 o'clock news this evening. Loads of food for thought there. Back after the break. Okay, Tom Coleman's a sleep expert and health scientist. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
You look like you got a good night's sleep, Tom.
Absolutely. I have to practice what I preach.
Indeed. Very good. Now, you've accepted our invite to come on, and we really appreciate it. And by the way, if you have any other questions about the quality of your sleep, please let us know. But this listener said, I've been having sleep paralysis on and off for a while. Normally, the black shadow would be at the bottom of the bed, and while very scary, I can handle it. Haven't had it for years and thought it has passed. The other night, it was on top of me, choking me, and to say it's frightening me is an understatement. The pain in my chest, I really thought I was going to have a heart attack. Even the next morning, the pain was still there. My bedroom's always been my safe place, the me time place in the house, and now I'm looking around me and I'm jumping at everything. The thought of going to bed frightens the life out of me now. Can anyone explain why this type of sleep happens, and what can I do to stop or control it? I've been Googling it, and they say don't fight it, to try and waken yourself, as it can be very dangerous. Right, Tom, there's a couple of things going on here, some that you might recognise.
Yeah.
The visuals that they talk of, I'm not sure if that's their mind or brain manifesting it, or if it's common, mm-hmm. but you're the expert, Tom. So is this something you've heard of before?
Yeah, and I suppose it's just to establish exactly what's happening. So, like, just to break down dreaming and hallucinations and things like that. So, generally, like, we should be dreaming in REM sleep. That's when it should be happening. And when that happens, we go into a state of self-induced paralysis, where the muscles just stop us from acting out our dreams, essentially, and that's a protective thing. And that's fine, but sometimes our dreams leak into other phases of sleep. So we have things like night terrors, which are exceptionally frightening, really vivid. But there is a difference between a night terror and a nightmare. So the night terrors tend to happen the first half of the night. And we don't tend to wake with those. And we don't tend to remember them very much. But this sounds different to a night terror. So there is a condition, sleep-wake disorder, known as isolated sleep paralysis. And that's where a person is experiencing the paralysis, atonia, it's known as, and they're waking up. Now, the other thing to note is that time and space, we've no concept of time when these things happen. It feels like an incredibly long time. So if a person is experiencing the paralysis, the wakefulness, and vivid hallucinations, it sounds like it is what is known as recurrent isolated sleep paralysis. There are risk factors for it. And I suppose there's not a huge amount of evidence in terms of the clinical literature on it, because many people that experience this feel, I suppose they feel like, am I going mad here? What's happening? And they're very confused. And they don't like to maybe speak about it.
They're inclined to believe in the supernatural, they might actually say, you know, they might be of the belief that something is happening in that regard, which might be another reason not to seek help.
That's right. I mean, people think, am I going mad here? What's happening? Because of how real they feel. And, you know, with this condition and with the night terrors, it really is as though there is another person in the room, or there is a person on top of you choking you. And, you know, it might be indicative of an underlying issue. And the thing about the choking, maybe with obstructive sleep apnea, we stop breathing and people get the sensation maybe of drowning or that. So, I mean, okay, so just looking at the risk factors for the isolated sleep paralysis, insomnia, insufficient sleep, if you're overtired, overstressed, certainly stress will play into it. Hypertension, so high blood pressure. Narcolepsy, so maybe there's a sleep condition there already. Sleep apnea is a risk factor as well. Alcohol use, post-traumatic stress disorder. So these are the kind of risk factors, and certain personality types. So that's what the literature is telling us. These are the risk factors here. So what type of interventions then can I recommend?
And before you get on to that, I think really, Tom, what you're highlighting here is that the person shouldn't be fearful, but just be alert that this could be indicative of something. So in other words, don't just put it down to a bad night's sleep. Do you know what I mean? To get it checked out and to make sure that that it doesn't have the consequences that potentially it could, Tom. So what is the next port of call? Is it GP? Is it, well, what do you do next then if you say, right, there's enough here for me to sort of pursue this a little more?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing, like you said, very correctly, is we want a clear diagnosis. because without that, we're guessing and we're throwing things at the problem. The nature of the problem will inform the solution. So go to your GP, ask for a referral for a sleep study, speak to your GP about it, and take it from there. Sleep specialist then will be able to analyze through polysomnography where you get wired up. And we can see then what's happening in the brainwave signature mm-hmm. of REM sleep and what's happening.
And does that happen in a location or at home?
Yes.
Okay. So
in a location. So you would have to go to there are lots of centers around
right.
that would do sleep studies with sleep scientists and clinicians in that sense. And that's you're into the medical arena of correct sleep diagnosis then of sleep wake disorders. So clear diagnosis from there, and then that would sort of indicate the path forward, which could go in many directions. That, you know, from lifestyle to there are cognitive therapies that will help you deal with that. But the first thing to, like you said, is not to read into it too much, is not to worry about it, is not to, you know, I suppose, get very fearful. We don't want that. The bed is a safe haven. Yeah.
And the brain is it's amazing for us, but it can work against us as well. And for some reason, it might be trying to make you not feel safe and content in your own room. Do you know what I mean? It could be anxiety or something as well. So you really have to make sure that you get the help that is required. I would say, Tom, and I'm not going to go through a load of snoring questions for you, but I mean, sleep experts, I would say they're sick and tired of people looking for one answer to snoring as if it's not a whole realm of different things with many different causes and all that type of stuff. Outside of getting a sleep study done and some deep dive analysis, is there anything anyone can actually do with anything on the market to relieve snoring?
Well, it's kind of, I suppose, a hierarchical view. We try A. If A doesn't work, we have a B plan, we have a C plan. So, I mean, it starts with something as simple as your sleep position. You don't sleep in your back. Mm. We do the lifestyle stuff first, right? So don't sleep in your back, sleep in your side. Elevate your bed by 3 or 4 degrees at the head of bed. Avoid alcohol. Alcohol relaxes the tongue and the muscles in the neck, and they hang back there, and that causes the vibration of the tissue.
And that's why people will often sleep for 8 hours even after a few drinks and feel exhausted in the morning. It's not good sleep.
Well, yeah, I mean, the alcohol is disrupting their sleep. That's why they don't feel great after. They're not getting the quality, and alcohol suppresses REM sleep as well. So those are the first things: the alcohol, the smoking. Weight loss, we gather tissues and fat in the neck, and often even we can grow polyps in the back of the neck, and all of that can contribute to snoring. So that's the first port of call, really, is all that lifestyle stuff. You can actually do exercises to strengthen the muscles in the tongue. Mm-hmm. There are oral exercises that you can get online, and you can practice these, and that it will increase the integrity of the tissues. Mm-hmm. So that may help. If you have any sinus issues, any congestion issues, get those sorted out. That could be the cause. That could help as well. And then we're going into the deeper...
Well, I've been told I've got fat tonsils, Tom.
Yeah.
What's
yeah.
that?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
And my son's got
You're
fat
lucky
tonsils.
If that's all you have.
He's got fat tonsils as well. A listener
says... There is a syndrome, and this is the actual name of it. This is the medical name of
right.
it. Big tongue syndrome.
Big tongue syndrome. Okay, well, that's there's a lot of bed divorces out there, Tom, over the back of this, so we're going to have to sort something out. This listener says, and this is common, actually, I think, because I've heard a couple of people say it to me. I'm in my early 70s. I wake 2 or 3 times a night, and then that's me. Can't get back to sleep. I was up this morning at 3:45. I didn't get back to sleep until 5 a.m., and then I was awake again at 7 a.m. So what does this type of sleep pattern, or why does it happen, and can I take anything or make any changes, preferably, presumably, to address that, Tom?
Okay. Yeah, okay, so here's why it's happening. When we're awake, we're building up what's called sleep pressure in the brain. That's building up, and that's one of the things that pushes you and holds you in sleep. And as the night, as you're sleeping, the sleep pressure is dropping. Your sleep cycles, so you sleep in cycles of 90 minutes. Your first couple of cycles, you're spending way more time in deep sleep. As the third and fourth, fifth cycle, you're spending, it's much lighter, the sleep. So as the sleep pressure is dropping and your sleep cycles are getting lighter, there's more of a tendency to wake up. As you age, you have a lot more of a tendency to wake up also. Now, I'm not too concerned about the wake episodes. It's getting you back to sleep. Now, you can entrain yourself to do this, and it takes practice. But what do most people do? They get stressed out. They go, oh, I'm awake again. They check the time. You know, they get blinded by the light of the phone, checking the time, and they're stressing. Now, I can tell you from working with people for years, the more you focus on sleep, the more elusive it becomes. So your goal here is relaxation. Okay? So try and do some breathing exercises, some visualizations, something that gives your brain some chewing gum, and the sleep will come back. Now, you won't get the deep sleep that you crave in the second half of the night. You've already had it. So light sleep is very valuable. It's when the psychological repair is happening, the brain is cleaning itself. So don't undervalue light sleep. Focus on relaxation, and you can entrain yourself to go back to sleep.
Yeah, it's so true, because I found myself waking up at exactly the same time every night. And it happened for about a week, and I was getting caught up in it. And then I kind of thought about it a bit and took a bit of emphasis off it, and then it stopped. But it was like clockwork. What do you think about watches? Callers asking about monitoring your sleep in the watch. I have a watch, and it monitors my sleep, and it scores my sleep out of 10. And often it does feel kind of good. It aligns to it. Now, I don't think you would make any judgments on the back of it, but just as a novelty sort of piece of technology, it does seem somewhat quite useful. But what's your view as a sleep expert?
It depends on the personality type. If you're a type A personality and you're waking up to check to see if you're hitting your sleep targets, you need to back away from it, right? Because we get those people.
Right.
In terms of the efficacy of the data, so that's what we kind of look at. The tech is pretty good at telling us if we're awake or asleep. Sometimes there's a lot more variance than when you go into the slow wave sleep or REM sleep in the analysis of that, depending on how light or heavy a sleeper you are. So I wouldn't read into that too much. In terms of, you know, people stressing out about, I'm not getting enough deep sleep.
Yeah, I hear you.
Your brain regulates that. It will actually hold you in deeper sleep longer.
Mm.
And people always focus on the deep sleep, but the light sleep is just as important for the psychological repair. So the tech, don't worry too much about it.
Yeah, and just very finally, is it really quite telling how we feel during the day? Because we often talk about how much sleep we're getting at night. If you don't get tired during the day, presumably you're getting a good night's sleep, or is that too big a jump?
No, I mean, it's a good indicator. Like, I've worked for 10 years in sleep, and I've met about two people who wake up feeling refreshed and ready for the day. You know, it takes a little while to wake up, right? But my question is, how do you feel after an hour? How do you feel? Are you experiencing tiredness during the day, daytime sleepiness? That's an indicator you might need more sleep. Sleep requirement is very personal. Some people are fine on 6 hours a night. The recommendation is five cycles or 7.5 hours. Some people require more. So sleep is deeply personal. Look at all of the things that you're doing during the day in terms of your outside activity, physical activity, your stress levels. The same systems that control stress control sleep. So if we look after all of the daytime stuff, the sleep will take care of itself.
Mm. Okay, brilliant stuff. Listen, that's been really interesting, especially the information about your body going into a form of paralysis during REM to stop you acting out your dreams. I thought that was really interesting. I haven't heard that before. It always, but that's what particularly jumped out at me. Tom, thank you so much for your help. Tom Coleman, sleep expert and health scientist. Now, a caller says, and it came in just a little late, my apologies, but the reason I'm mentioning it now, because this is a good conversation that listeners can help with. I'm about to start 3 weeks of night shift. Any advice to get sleep in the morning? I've never done this before and I'm slightly concerned now. The different shifts, night versus day, continental shifts, they're called. A lot of people in the county are employed on the shifts where you work a number of nights, then you work a couple of days in the health service, in care homes. There's loads of different places out there. So maybe you could give us your advice on how you deal with your sleep. If you're working continental shifts or then night shifts and then day shifts. The best advice often is out there in listener land, so please let us know. Right, that is where we have to leave it on the show today. Thank you so much for a really busy start to the week. A lovely Monday with so many of you messaging in and texting in. It's greatly appreciated. We will be back with you tomorrow morning at 9. So have a fantastic Tuesday.